AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, May 2nd, 2010, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking with author of a brand new book that just came out, an extraordinary new book, Enlightened Sexism. What is happening in popular culture and in our news media and our media generally with regard to sexism and women? How do we explain what's going on? Today we're going to have a great author explaining the situation as she sees it, as she lays it out in her new book. Our guest will be Susan Douglas. But before we go to Sue Douglas, sit back, relax, and enjoy Media Minutes, and we'll be back with you in five.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
More than 500 arts advocates took to Capitol Hill on April 13th for the 23rd Arts Advocacy Day. The event focuses on the importance of developing strong public policies and increasing public funding for the arts. Advocates gathered to learn about the issues and how to advocate effectively for them on Capitol Hill. Jack Walsh, co-director of the National Alliance for Media, Art, and Culture, or NAMAC, was among the participants.
On NAMAC's behalf, I went to five meetings with regional leader staffs to talk about the importance of not only funding the NEA and the NEH and asking for more funds for those agencies because they had been defunded during the culture wars in the 90s, but also talking about such important issues as artist visas to come into the country, the need for arts education to be funded at higher levels, and of course, importantly in terms of our concern, issues like net neutrality.
Walsh says that net neutrality, the fundamental principle that protects the free flow of information online, impacts NAMAC directly because media arts organizations need an open internet, not only to make media, but to advertise and distribute their work.
Since the artists that are supported by our organizations are working in media that takes up a lot of bandwidth, oftentimes that media can be in contradiction to or opposition to commercial media. So I think that these organizations, especially the larger organizations, are really looking at wanting to have access to their audiences through the internet because they're understanding more and more that it's going to be of importance as they move forward.
Much of the work of arts organizations will be showcased on the web, and they need to be on a level playing field in order to thrive.
It could be something as simple as you want to take clips of work that are shown in your performance space and put them out over the internet, and if you don't have the same bandwidth speeds to do that with, it means that your work will become much more sluggish, which means, as we all know, in the world of the internet, that things that are troubling and problematic in terms of how we receive them tend to be the sites that people go to less. So these arts that are primarily in the nonprofit sector will become marginalized as a result of that if they don't have the same access to the internet.
For more information on NAMAC, go to namac.org.
A new report released by grantmakers in film and electronic media shows that commercial media investment beats philanthropy by a factor of as much as 400 to 1. Grantmakers in Film and Electronic Media is an association of funders committed to advancing the field of media arts and public interest media funding. Executive Director Alice Myatt says that the disparity between commercial and nonprofit media was well known, but the degree of that disparity was not.
We wanted to try to figure out how many philanthropic dollars were going towards the support of media. It was important, we felt, given that media determines virtually everything we think and do and act upon, it's pervasive. The entire world is driven by what comes through the media.
Myatt says it's difficult to quantify how much money goes to media projects.
the field has really been rooted in anonymity and autonomy, whether we're talking about big institutional funders or small private donors. So the question was, what are the impediments to figuring out how much? And knowing how much and where, then we can more effectively identify the gaps.
Collaboration among funders is the key to most of the report's recommendations, which include creating a comprehensive platform for information sharing on grantees and developing new networked media production and distribution systems. Part of GFAM's mission is to educate funders about various media platforms, like dramatic films, community radio, and internet crowdsourcing technology. Myatt travels the globe, bringing funders to meet media makers wherever they may be, so that philanthropists understand how different types of projects can be helpful to their mission.
We recently took a funder delegation to South by Southwest Interactive. If your issue is community development or education reform or disaster preparedness and relief, you need to come and see what applications are being developed, not only for the web, but also for mobile phones. Funders need to be smarter about all of these platforms that are available.
To read the report, Funding Media Strengthening Democracy, go to gfem.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live on WILL AM 580 this May 2nd, 2010. Our guest today is Susan Douglas, who's the author of numerous books, including Where the Girls Are and The Mommy Myth, for which she was a guest on our program a few years ago when it was published. And she has a brand new book out, which I've had the privilege of reading this past couple weeks, The Enlightened Sexism, the Seductive Message that Feminism's Work Has Done. Susan J. Douglas is a professor and the chair of the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Michigan. Susan, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, just to clear things up, I've got a copy of the book. Is it in stores now? Is it formally released?
Yes, it's out. Uh-huh.
Excellent. And, I want to tell you, I really enjoyed reading the book. It's a book that's, as the other book is called, It's Long Overdue. Hitting issues that a lot of people have been thinking about, but no one's really put in such a crystallized form with so much material as you've done in this book.
Well, thanks, Bob.
And, you know, for the sake of listeners, let's just start at the basics. You call the book Enlightened Sexism. What is that? Why is that the title of your book, and why is that a problem?
Well, enlightened sexism refers to this new common sense that I found in the media that emerges out of a set of mixed messages surrounding women, and the basic assumption or premise is that women have achieved full equality. So everything's equal, the women's movement has been a total success, full equality has been achieved, and therefore it's okay to resurrect sexist images of women because they can't hurt us anymore. And so as a result, we've been seeing a resurgence of sexist images, especially those geared to, I would say, young women. But this has been at war with a kind of embedded feminism as well that has also been, you know, directed at women like me. So it's this contradictory brew. And this kind of sexism is not as in-your-face as, you know, straight-out sexism that says, oh, women can't achieve anything, women should be second-class citizens. It's much more sneaky and subtle.
In the book, basically, as I see it, is, you know, you review popular culture, for the most part, a little bit of news media, but primarily popular culture for the last two decades. Why is popular culture play really the centerpiece of your examination?
Well, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, I did Where the Girls Are, which came out in 94, and the book did very well, and so as a result, I did a lot of talks around the country. And, you know, I think that book really hit a nerve because it did lay out, not just to women, but to men as well, the way in which the mass media, you know, play a powerful role in constituting who we are, what we think is possible and isn't possible, what's beauty, what's success, all the rest. But as you know, popular culture can have a short shelf life after a while. And so by 2002, 2005, people were saying, well, what about Ally McBeal? What about Buffy? What about Desperate Housewives? And so it seemed like, you know, it was time for, you know, a sequel. So I began in the early 90s, which is where the Girls Are left off, and, did a tour through popular culture right up to the present.
Now, I know what you've been doing for the last 15 years while I was watching basketball games. But you've watched virtually every program imaginable, it seems like.
Well, actually, you know, thank you, boxed DVD sets, you know, because there were some things that I did not watch or didn't watch in their entirety in the past. And what's terrific for media researchers now is, you know, between stuff that's online and the boxed DVD set, there's a lot of research that you can do right in your living room, which is great.
And before we go through some of the popular culture, because it's what the book constitutes, and it's really superb media criticism, let's talk about the notion of irony, because it seems to really be crucial to the argument you're making. You make a point of this in your introduction. Talk about the importance of irony.
Yeah, you know, I have found this so interesting in doing the research, and I noticed this especially with MTV, but not exclusively. There have been many other programs, particularly reality programs, that deploy this. So basically, the show will present to you, you know, whether it's the Desperate Housewives of Orange County or New York, or some incredibly spoiled girl on My Super Sweet 16 who's going to have, you know, a Super Sweet 16 party that costs hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, or the kids on The Real World. You know, you're presented with these people who act in ways that are shallow, materialistic. The women in particular get into catfights over guys they barely know, and so on and so forth. But it's all done with a wink. So MTV presents this stuff as if they know that you know that they know that you know, you know, that you're not really going to take this straight. You're not going to just watch it and just accept it. It's designed to make you feel superior to the people who are on the screen, to have a very ironic, knowing, smirky take on it, so that you're not only envying the girl on the Super Sweet 16 whose father's going to get her, you know, a new Land Rover and a Mercedes and a, you know, Vegas-style floor show for her Super Sweet 16. You're also meant to condescend to her, to feel superior to her, because the show flatters you that you're not as banal and narcissistic as she is. So, you know, you're invited to think that you have this kind of shield against the blandishments of the mass media, and the shows sort of present you with one. But having said that, it still invites you to and urges you to assume a worldview in which the characters on the show are stereotypical. They promote stereotypes about women as shallow, materialistic, obsessed with relationships, and so on and so forth. And so their underlying value system is that women are or should be measured by their appearance, their sexuality, and, you know, so that seeps in, you know, despite that shield of irony.
And it also seeps in from, you know, the experience I have as a father of two daughters, 14 and 22, in that that's all you're exposed to. So irony or no irony, there's no contrasting images you're getting in popular culture, or very few that I've seen.
Well, you know, I one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was, you know, I was in the middle of raising a teenage daughter at the time, and I was so struck by, you know, some of the divisions between us and the tensions between us, and I began to appreciate, and you've written about this as well, how the mass media have served to really heighten those divisions along kind of hyper-commercialization. And so, you know, my daughter was being urged to be obsessed with logos and shopping, and there was kind of a rank ordering of the logos that she was supposed to buy into. And she was also being urged all the time to turn herself into a sex object. And, you know, now I'm a member of the baby boom generation. There would not have been a sexual revolution without us. But this is different. This is about corporations tapping into young women's desires to have sexual agency and freedom and twisting it around and exploiting it to urge them then to turn themselves willingly into sex objects. And so it was this kind of divide that I found the media really exacerbating between my daughter and myself that I kind of wanted to really dive into.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Susan Douglas, the author of the brand new book, Enlightened Sexism, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done, just published, just out by Times Books. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, our phone lines are open. This is a live program. The number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Susan Douglas, I want to talk a bit about the 1990s. It's a big part of your narrative, but there's so much rich material more recently that I think all of our listeners will recognize, or most anyone certainly with children will recognize, but even without children. But I do want to go into the 1990s because one of the points you make is that things have changed so much since the early 1990s, and doing your research in terms of a number of the issues, primarily the sexualization of our culture.
Yeah, you know, when I was doing Where the Girls Are, you know, I was starting in the late 40s, early 50s, when the feminine mystique was so, you know, taking hold and really holding women back. But I ended in the early 90s when so much had been achieved. So it was, you know, there was some progress there. This has been an interesting twist for me because I start in the 1990s and we forget how much feminist ferment there was back then. And a lot of it was from young women. So on the one hand, with older women, 1992 was proclaimed the year of the woman because so many women ran for Congress and won in the wake of the way in which Anita Hill was treated during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. It infuriated women and who felt that she had not been treated respectfully at all by an all-male Senate committee. So we had the year of the woman. We had studies coming out about young women losing their self-esteem once they became teenagers, and that put Mary Piper's Reviving Ophelia on the bestseller list for like 3 years. We had the Riot Girl movement. We had Take Back the Night rallies on college campuses. All kinds of stuff was going on that led to this consolidated movement that was called Girl Power in the mid and late 1990s. And so it was very interesting to go back and look at all of that energy and to see actually where we are now, which has been in many ways a regression back from that kind of sense of possibility and opportunity for young women.
What were some of the, you've mentioned Riot Girls, what were some of the other, you know, high points in popular culture for women in the 1990s, if you could identify them?
Well, one was certainly Sassy magazine, and which was proclaimed by its fans to be the best teen girl magazine of all time, which I couldn't agree with more. And I was actually able to find an entire run of them at the Pop Culture Library at Bowling Green, and it was just great to go back and look at that magazine. That magazine saw Seventeen and its ilk as, you know, the antichrist of, you know, pop culture for young women. And so they made fun of Cosmo. They made fun of Seventeen. They did write about fashion, and they did write about, your complexion and that sort of thing. But they also had great stories about gay teens. They were one of the first teen magazines to talk about homosexuality, to talk about immigration, to talk about poverty. And it was done. It was fun. The way it was written was fun. So I would regard that as a high point. Certainly many young women regard the music of Riot Girl as a high point. But, you know, there was also other stuff in popular culture, like Northern Exposure, in which you had a woman being a bush pilot, much more technically competent than the poor doctor in town. Another older woman who runs the general store, one of the few really rich, rounded depictions we've seen of older women in popular culture. We, of course, had Roseanne, who was a working-class feminist on television, and Grace Under Fire, also working-class, Murphy Brown. So there were a lot of things that were really fun for women to watch and had a very, very explicit feminist sensibility.
And two of the shows you write about at some length from the 90s, and I guess they might have extended in the early part of the new century, were Xena and the Warrior Vampire Princess. Xena the Warrior Princess, is that it?
Yes.
And Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I want to get these right. And I confess, it's not a snob thing. I didn't catch these shows, but I heard a lot about them.
Yeah.
From people who did watch them and liked them a great deal.
Well, they were both huge cult hits. And, you know, Josh Whedon, who's the creator of Buffy and is a self-proclaimed male feminist, did that show, produced that show, because he was tired of seeing young women always being the victims in horror movies. And he wanted to turn the tables and have a young woman be a hero. And so we got Buffy, who was the only person, a teenage girl, who can save the world from the fang-toothed evil of the vampires, you know, constantly disgorging out of the hellmouth. And I think it was enormously satisfying for young women and even older women to see that show, because it was in that period in the, you know, mid to late 90s when what young women were talking about and concerned about were not legal forms of legal discrimination against women, because so many of those had been tackled in the 70s. They were concerned about violence against women and sexual safety and so on and so forth. And that show was very empowering because it captured that fear, cast it in metaphorical terms, and then, you know, turn the tables. Xena was emerged out of this completely trashy, kitschy syndicated show called Hercules, and mm-hmm. she was a, you know, a bad female villain. Well, they turned her into somebody who wanted to, you know, mend her ways, and of course she went through the land, and the land was sometime between ancient Greece and the Middle Ages, you weren't quite sure. And she was constantly leveling, you know, stubble-faced hordes of, you know, murdering, raping barbarians and doing it single-handedly. So, you know, there was a great deal of satisfaction in these shows. And Xena, especially, which had some producers who were lesbian, walked this very fine line of letting people read Xena as either gay or straight. And both shows were big hits, and so it was really fun to watch them again. It was fun to write about them, and it was fun to think about them, because on the one hand, these were fantasies of power that women clearly liked. On the other hand, you know, you still had to be slim, size zero, gorgeous, etc. I mean, Xena did have some meat on her bones, but she was still, you know, very beautiful and very scantily clad. And the other question about power is, you know, as we fantasize as women about having power, is our only choice to be as physically strong and violent as Jackie Chan, you know? So, you know, what the media giveth with one hand, as you know all too well, they taketh away with the other.
The term you use, Susan, for the late 90s, I believe, is the rise of what you call the new girliness.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? What's that all about?
Well, you know, what began to happen with what has been called third wave feminism, you know, the young women who saw themselves as feminists in the 1990s, but didn't see them having to fight the same battles that my generation did, because a lot of those had been fought and won, again, around, you know, legal discrimination, economic discrimination, so on and so forth. And one of the things that some young feminists were saying is, why do we have to repudiate things that are stereotypically feminine? If we do that, aren't we buying into a sort of sexist playbook that says only the hobbies, the activities, et cetera, that boys and young men engage in are legitimate, and the ones that we love and embrace are illegitimate? So there was an effort among some young women to say, wait a minute, this kind of celebration of girliness, we should celebrate girls, and we should not think that our activities and pastimes are ridiculous. Now, anytime you have anything like that, it's going to get co-opted by commercial forces and pushed to the nth degree. So you began to see, and I do think very much, Bob, that young women in the 90s and beyond were trying very much to figure out, how do you fuse some relationship, some compromise, some whole coherent self that is feminist but also feminine? Because the fact of the matter is, we live in a culture that is gender obsessed, and it is important still to have some elements of femininity if you're going to survive in a male-dominated culture. It's just as simple as that. So how do you keep that and also be a strong, independent woman? So there were a lot of movies and TV shows that were trying to calibrate that balance. And what emerged was this kind of new girliness that came out of movies like Clueless, Miss Congeniality, Legally Blonde. And again, I loved all of these movies, and they're fun and interesting to watch. And what you see is a drama. If you take Legally Blonde, for example, for those two people who haven't seen this movie.
Well, anyone who has daughters our age has seen it, as you put it, I think, 24 times.
Yeah, I've seen it a billion times. And there are things about it that are very satisfying. But here's Reese Witherspoon, plays a dumb blonde, very girly, who's boyfriend dumps her and goes to Harvard Law School to find another, a more appropriate future wife. She applies to Harvard, gets in, is ridiculed for being too girly, and through a process, she becomes a serious student and she becomes successful at the law. And you watch the way in which she has to reject certain elements of this, you know, hot pink girliness along the way to be successful, but not to lose it entirely. And so it's a drama about that. And but you see, in this effort for some young women to hold on to things that have been defined as female, as legitimate, you see the entertainment industry pushing a new kind of new girliness that is then going to do really well at selling, you know, all kinds of products, including, as you know, mentioned in your earlier question and I haven't addressed yet, highly sexualized clothing for ever younger and younger girls.
Let's go into that in a second. Our guest today is Susan Douglas, the author of the brand new book, Enlightened Sexism: The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Has Done. Susan Douglas is the chair and an endowed professor at the University of Michigan, the Department of Communication Studies. She's been a guest on this program before, and we're discussing her new book tonight, or today, I should say. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Let's go to a caller right now. Let's go to line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Thanks. First, I just want to say that I wanted to thank you for having this show. This is a topic that I think about a lot, and I can't wait to go out and buy your book. But I'm in my late 30s, so I subscribe to Sassy. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on just what is going on. Like, why isn't sexism something that's really talked about? You're one of the few women that I've heard in a long time really talking about these kind of issues, when salaries for women are still lower than men's. You turn on the program, especially children's programming, too. Main characters are still largely male. What's up in our society that we seem to be accepting this? Why isn't it something that's on the radar screen? And one of the things that really brought this up to me, that this is really still a huge issue, was when Hillary Clinton ran against Barack Obama in the primary, and how awfully I felt she was treated by the media, and it largely went kind of unchallenged. So I just thought if you could speak to that, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller. Susan Douglas?
Sure. Thanks so much. Thanks for a great comment. I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, the subtitle of my book is The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Has Done. But part of the seduction, and a very powerful component of it, is, in fact, intimidation. Do not bring this up. And I think that, you know, what we have now is, and what young women actually, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s and beyond have been saying to me as the book has come out, is that there is this new problem with no name, and we need to give it a name, which I've tried to do. And that problem is young women being told they could be and do anything, and then they get out in the workforce and not so much. So how do we explain this? There has been a very successful, and I would say pretty relentless, demonization of feminism in the mass media, kind of across the board. I think it is really hard to think of a social movement that has done so much for so many people, and not just women, men and kids too, that has been so successfully and thoroughly vilified, you know, in the media and beyond. So I do have various examples in the book of feminist characters and how they're portrayed, you know, in various television shows and movies. And all of this is a warning. And so a crucial element of enlightened sexism is the repudiation of feminism. It is to tell young women that whatever they want or whatever they think they might do, the one thing they can't and should not do is embrace feminism, because feminism will allegedly make them unhappy, unlovable, strident, angry, so on and so forth. And I actually think young women in their heart of hearts miss feminism. So you're right, sexism isn't being talked about because it's more subtle and insidious. And so you're right, I'm trying to put this back on the table. I think it's very important, and there are tons of statistics I can cite, and if we can, and I'll hold off on them for right now, that document the enormous gap between the imagery we see in the media and the reality of most women's lives.
In the second part of your question, Susan Douglas, you write about it at length in the book, so I was going to ask you about it later, but let's jump to it right now. You go through how some, not just later in the book, but early in the book with Janet Reno, but how successful women in public life and politics are treated by the news media and the double standard they face compared to men in similar positions.
Right. I wrote about Janet Reno. We can come back to her in a minute. And, and then I had to write about the women in the 2008 campaign, particularly Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, Michelle Obama. But also about some of these high dramas around powerful women, Katie Couric, being the first solo anchor, Martha Stewart, who got a lot more negative press than any of the Enron guys, who clearly ruined many more people's lives than Martha Stewart ever did. So there is an enormous anxiety still in the media about women with power, and the caller is totally right. The things that were said about Hillary Clinton, the subtle ways in which she was demonized, really exposed this fear and anxiety that she aroused that Sarah Palin did not, because Hillary Clinton is a feminist and Sarah Palin is not a feminist. She's an anti-feminist. And Sarah Palin is also very hyper-feminine, and while Hillary Clinton is an attractive woman, she doesn't do the peep-toe shoes and all the rest. And so Hillary Clinton aroused, ironically, much more negative coverage, I would say, than Sarah Palin did. Sarah Palin got done in by interviews, and particularly by women. She got done in by Tina Fey, by Katie Couric, and by Campbell Brown, who, for them, Sarah Palin was an insult to what they had achieved. It was important for me to look at real women, everyday women, and women with power, and how those real women are treated in the media versus how the fictional ones are treated.
Our guest, Susan Douglas, we're discussing her brand new book, Enlightened Sexism, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Has Done. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. We have a full bank of callers. We're going to get to you all now. Let's start in with line 4, Peoria. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Hi. Would you say something about the women in the military? There was the fabricated story around Jessica Lynch, and yet women seem to be subject to sexual predation in the military. And women seeing the military as a way to move up in the world, that's kind of like the masculine, they've adapted the masculine point of view. Okay.
Thank you, caller. Susan Douglas?
Yeah, this is a terrible scandal. It's a terrible scandal. And I don't write about it in the book. I just wasn't in the purview of what I was doing.
Well, you do mention Tailhook from the 90s.
I do mention Tailhook from the 90s. This was just one of those scandals. There were various things that activated women in the early 1990s, and in addition to the Clarence Thomas hearings, Tailhook was a huge one when women at a Tailhook party had to run a gauntlet and were grabbed and physically abused and harassed. These were female military officers, and so there was that scandal. And they have tried to instituted various sexual harassment programs and all the rest. But we are still getting terrible reports about levels of sexual violence and harassment that women in the military face, that when they report it, they are either don't get a hearing at all or are, you know, reassigned or demoted. The call is right. That is just one of many pieces of evidence about the gap between image and reality and how far we have not come in confronting sexism in our society.
There's absolutely a great book to be written on that subject, and the sooner the better.
Yeah.
Let's go now to line two. Farina, you're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And to me, this is a bigger subject than racism. I swear, to me, it's much bigger than racism. I wanted to mention two things that, you're going to love this. I think women are the superior branch of the human race. I don't see how women really even put up with men in a lot of cases. But anyway, what I really called for was the great thing that NASA, I don't know how great this is, but it just seems great to me that NASA has included many women in its astronaut corps. Peggy Whitson was commander of the space station for many months, and then the last shuttle flight had three women on it, and there's currently a woman on the station. And I don't know how, like the last caller, I don't know how much of their femininity they've given up to be in the astronaut corps, but I just love the fact that, like, when I watched the NASA channel, the woman from the Japanese Space Agency had a major part, the Megan McCormick in the Hubble resurfacing was a major part in the robotic manipulation. And that's all I really had to say. I love women. Okay, and this is a very important topic. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Susan, there is a lot there for you to maybe consider, but if I can redirect the first part of that, because you mentioned the relationship of sexism to racism, I know you have what I think is one of the best chapters in the book on African-American women specifically, and that sort of conjuncture
yeah.
of sexism and racism.
Well, I'm happy to hear that from the caller. I mean, you know, we've gotten all of this drivel about now that Obama's been elected, we live in a, you know, post-racial age, which of course has been demonstrated almost immediately to be patently false. And the thing about sexism is that it simply affects more people because there are just more women in the country. But that intersection between sexism and racism is such a double whammy for African-American women. And, you know, when I did Where the Girls Are, and I was writing primarily about the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, even the 80s, there were not that many media texts that featured African-American women. There were a few here and there. And so, you know, I could write about music and so forth. But with this book, you know, I could write much more about African-American women in the media because Fox, when it was trying to launch its network, really showcased African-American sitcoms as a way to get its foot in the door. And those were simultaneously empowering and also, you know, denigrating images of women. But what I've been very interested in is this emergence of the sassy African-American woman, the one who rolls her eyes with her hands on her hips. And this is, you know, a stereotype that is simultaneously marginalizing of African-American women. The real-life African-American women I know do not talk or, you know, gesticulate that way at all. And on the other hand, I did want to dig into myself and think about why I found Wanda Sykes' performance of the sassy black woman, for example, so satisfying. And I think it's in part because of the way in which black women can use that persona to talk back to patriarchy in very funny and powerful ways. But the intersection between racism and sexism is just such a whammy for African-American women and other women of color.
Our guest, Susan Douglas, author of the brand new book, Enlightened Sexism, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. This is a live show, so if you want to call in with questions, the number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Professor Douglas, I appreciate the talk, and I'm just wondering, and I think the caller kind of touched upon it previously, but if you talk about Asian American women and the commodification of their bodies in terms of, you know, them being orientalized in a very derogatory way, I appreciate your talk again, and I'm glad that this subject is on tonight, today, and I myself identify as a feminist, so thank you.
Susan Douglas, you want to field that?
Yes. You know, there have been so few representations of Asian American women in the media. I mean, talk about, you know, erasure. And when they do appear, they're either as very passive, submissive, quiet women, you know, the absolute stereotype of the submissive Asian woman, or they're dragon ladies. And so, you know, I was really disappointed that Ally McBeal, a show that, you know, one can love and hate at the same time, nonetheless had Lucy Liu in this kind of dragon lady role. And the representations are minimal, and we see very few that are outside of those kinds of stereotypes.
You know, Susan Douglas, before we go to our next caller, such a, to me, striking part of the book we haven't really gone to yet, which is in the second half, deals with, you reviewed apparently every reality television show ever made, for which I think you deserve combat pay of the highest order. But also it leads in then into a discussion of what's happening to the images of women's bodies and how women are coming to regard their bodies that I think is extraordinarily, frankly, depressing to read. But it also resonates well because it's exactly what you see in our culture. Just before we go to the next caller, talk a little bit about this. I don't want listeners to leave this program without knowing what's in this book about this.
Well, I did watch an unbelievable amount of reality TV, and I thank you for the combat pay proposal because I think that that feels about right. But, you know, I do think that we've seen an increased sexualization of young women, and it's moved farther and farther down the age chain. I don't know if you've seen this dreadful book, I mean dreadful TV show. It's called Toddlers and Tiaras.
I read about it, but it sounds hideous, unbelievable.
It's absolutely awful. They feature 2- and 3-year-olds now. You know, this is like even moving down from JonBenet Ramsey. So it's 2- and 3-year-olds, still in diapers, some of them, who have fake spray tans on and their hair all teased up and makeup on, and they have to learn how to strut their stuff, these little toddlers. So in a variety of reality TV shows, whether it's The Bachelor or The Real World or moving on down to Toddlers and Tiaras, we have these have been instructional manuals for young women on how to be hot, how to perform their sexuality, and it's moved farther and farther down the age chain. When I've just started giving talks based on the book, and when I show this one slide, which is a display in a store of thongs for little girls, like 4-year-olds, and they have Mickey Mouse on them, you know, the entire audience gasps. And so, you know, the lesson, and then, of course, we've had MTV's Spring Break stuff and Girls Gone Wild. And what all of those do is they tell, I mean, here's the kind of syllogism that happens. Young women want to have sexual agency and control over their bodies and the kind of equality with men, okay? So what the marketers do is come back and say, great, great. We want you to turn yourself into a sex object because it's very profitable for us, but we're going to sell it to you in such a way that you choose to be a sex object because you find it empowering. And the sort of rationale here is your body is beautiful. You should be proud of it. You should flash your breasts for anybody because that's power. Well, you know, if that was power, you know, Dick Cheney would be exposing himself, you know, on his way to work, you know. So these reality TV shows have been particularly, I think they've been kind of the ground zero of enlightened sexism.
You know, one of the things in the book, too, and I do want to alert our callers who are waiting, I will get to you, but I want to get this in, was the discussion of the change in the way women's bodies are presented as the ideal body. And what was most striking to me, Susan, in the book was you went through a list of, like, all these very prominent, beautiful actresses from the 1970s that you said you'd admired and followed. And you then, you know, none of them were known for their breasts. I mean,
right.
And then you went just discussing this, what you call mammary mania today. And the sort of now that women feel an obligation to have these, you know, spectacularly large breasts to be, you know, legitimate.
Well, you know, it's an impossible body ideal, Bob. I mean, Twiggy was one thing. You know, she was impossibly thin, but she wasn't stacked because women that thin usually aren't. And, you know, this body ideal is, it's very, very slim and tall and hugely busty. So we just, like, take the body of a 12-year-old boy and, you know, Photoshop Pamela Anderson's breasts on it. That's the, you know, ideal body type. And, you know, that has been a very important body type to market. Look how much money Victoria's Secret has made in trying to make that the, you know, kind of perfect ideal of female beauty. There has been an explosion in breast augmentation surgeries and advertising for breast augmentation just, you know, in the last 5 years. So, you know, this is both an impossible and destructive body image.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Our guest again, Susan Douglas, author of the brand new book, Enlightened Sexism. Let's now go to line three, Logansport, Indiana. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Professor Douglas.
It's worth the wait because she started talking about the area I want to talk about, or at least bring up. And she mentioned about the marketing. And before that, she mentioned about manufacturers trying to sexualize clothing for very young girls. That's something I picked up on. Not, you know, recently, but a while back I started seeing that trend. And it bothered me because there's enough of that going on with the girls themselves from, you know, previous role models and stuff. And it concerns me that at such a young age, their psyches are not set up in any way whatsoever to understand the power of sexuality and how situations might arise for, in a sense, it's almost like promoting molestation. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Susan, can I just ask you one thing along these lines for your next caller? Because it comes out in the comments you've made so far, and it's implicit and at times explicit in your book. How much of all of this stuff with enlightened sexism can be attributed to commercialism? And I ask that because when I think of public radio and community radio and TV, and I think of largely non-commercial or only quasi-commercial venues, it doesn't seem like the issue is anywhere near severe.
Yeah, well, you know, as I said in the beginning of the interview, there are two streams operating here, and one is embedded feminism. You know, feminism is no longer outside of culture or outside of the mainstream media the way it was in the 1960s and early 1970s. It's become woven into the weft and warp of our culture and our mass media. So we do see various media depictions, many of them, you know, that I watch and love, of women who are accomplished. They are doctors, you know, surgeons, lawyers, district attorneys, chiefs of police, so on and so forth. And then in other media fare, you know, you do have women, smart, accomplished women who are either experts or reporters in the news media and so on and so forth. And how and why have we gotten that? We've gotten that because there has been a genuine desire among well-intentioned progressive people in the media who want to show women having achieved the same kind of proficiency and success as men. There have been people who've wanted to produce, you know, what one would call role model media. And, you know, whether it's Shonda Rhimes, the creator of Grey's Anatomy, or others, you know, that's been a very genuine desire to show accomplished women in the media. So, on the other hand, of course, there's a very powerful commercial drive to get women to buy as much stuff as possible. After all, women remain, you know, the consumers of, you know, about 80% of, you know, the shopping is done by women. And to get women to buy stuff, the mass media have to simultaneously flatter us and degrade us. They have to make us feel like, if I just had that, I'd look better. If I just had that, I'd feel better about myself. And so there's an enormous commercial push. And as you've written about in your work so much, Bob, with the increased consolidation, you know, of media systems, the commercial push is even farther and farther. And so you do get this rampant sexualization. And just to get back to the previous caller's comment, there was a study done by the American Psychological Association that looked at girls' responses to this increased sexualization moving down the age chain, and it has a very destructive effect on girls' self-esteem. And what I found, in talking about the images of women in the media around the country, you know, this crosses the political spectrum. I have spoken to very conservative parents and very progressive parents, and they are united in their real outrage and reaction against this kind of sexualization of young girls. They find it creepy.
Susan Douglas, our guest today, professor at the University of Michigan, author of Enlightened Sexist and the book we've been discussing for the last hour. Let's go to another caller now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. You were talking about irony earlier, and I have it's a cultural bias now. Whenever I see a Fox News girl with her lip gloss, my immediate response to that is to not take the person seriously. And so I'm just wondering, Sarah Palin likes lip gloss. It's all over the Fox News thing. Mara Liasson has to wear it. I'll bet it's probably not by her choice, but she always shows up on Sunday morning with it. So do you think, how long is it going to be before lip gloss becomes culturally ironic and people look at that maybe the same way they do false eyelashes?
Well, thank you very much, caller. Susan Douglas?
Yeah, who knows? But, I was just talking to somebody recently who is who's a sports broadcaster, and I'll refrain from using her name, but she's a very eminent one. And she is very concerned about what's happening in sports broadcasting with women because she got into it by really knowing her sports. You know, she was an athlete herself, but she was an avid follower of a variety of sports and had enormous expertise and knowledge. So it took a lot to break in as a woman to that field. And now she's finding that some of these younger women who are trying to break in or get in primarily because they're beautiful, they wear the lip gloss, and they're posing in Playboy and they're posing in Maxim. And she's just like, that sets us back, 50 years, because how are people going to take us seriously if we are looked at as primarily eye candy who, as the caller says, wear lip gloss, and right away is not going to take them seriously because it's almost like this sign that says, I was hired for my looks and my lips and not for my brains.
We've got one more caller I want to get to. Let's now go to line 1, Champagne. You're on the air with Susan Douglas.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed your presentation. I'm looking forward to reading your book. I wanted to change to a slightly different topic that you mentioned before, which was the vilification of feminism in the media. And I think that probably a number of other social movements have also been vilified in the movement, the anti-war movement, certain elements of the civil rights movement or black liberation struggle, and certainly the trade union movement have been vilified in the media. And I wonder if you might comment on any parallels and differences between the kinds of vilification that's been directed at feminists as compared to some other social movements. Thank you.
Susan Douglas?
Yeah, that's a great comment. And, there's a scholar named Lauren Berlant who has written about a particular kind of citizenship that started to get sort of promoted in the 1980s and beyond. And it's a very private, infantile kind of citizenship that discourages and looks down on and resents public activism of a variety of sorts. And so I think that has swept across the board, and there's also been a very successful conservative swipe at a variety of these movements. And as a baby boomer, I've actually been thinking about this a lot. I think we are one of the most vilified generations, you know, that we are allegedly narcissistic and just self-absorbed and all the rest. And when you think about what the civil rights movement accomplished, what the anti-war movement accomplished, the women's movement, you know, workers' trade union movement, gay rights movements, you know, they have changed our society. And but there has been this great sort of, you know, bias against this kind of activism as if you're too rude, but it's also very undercovered, you know, and so it's been quite ironic to me that the teabag movement has, which, you know, is simply a rebranding of the Republican base and actually not a very big movement, has gotten so much coverage compared to the other kind of activist movements, you know, that have been out there for a long time. I think the caller's totally right.
Susan Douglas, we've only got a couple minutes left. And one question that occurred to me as I read the book, and I suspect you may have had similar experiences. I think there's some data along these lines, but I don't know it well enough, which is when I look at my daughter's peers, my daughter is graduating from college in a couple of weeks, my older daughter, and when I look at the students I've been teaching, I've noticed in the last two decades that women are doing a lot better than boys of the similar age group since I came into academia in the 1980s. And apparently there's some data to bear that out, which is sort of an ironic or interesting statistical development in view of what's going on with our popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there's a tremendous tension there. We have a situation where women are disproportionately succeeding in academia, young women, and I eventually assume that will translate into success professionally. Yet we have this popular culture, as you point out, which is just enlightened is a very generous term for sexism. How's this going to play out?
Well, you know, I don't know, and I don't have the data in front of me either. More women have been going to college than young men. In a state like Michigan, you know, even 10 years ago, if you were a young man and you didn't go to college, there were jobs that would pay you well in construction, in industry, you know, in the trades, so on and so forth. Whereas for young women, if you didn't go to college, you were stuck in a low-paying, dead-end job. With the Great Recession, of course, that's changed things some. And so for young women to get out of, you know, a job that pays basically $27,000 a year with no room to move, you know, you have to go to college. That wasn't quite as true for men. It's mm-hmm. getting more true now. But, you know, however well young women are doing in college, it's still the case that a year out of college, women earn 80% of what men make, and 10 years out, they make 69% of what men make. Young men are four times more likely to negotiate their first salary than young women, and that results in about $500,000 in earnings by the age 60. So, you know, whatever's going on in college and however much young women are succeeding in college, that is not yet translating into across-the-board success or even parity with young men.
Susan Douglas, it's been great having you. We've got about 30 seconds, 45 seconds left before we have to tie up here. Real quickly, people who are concerned about this issue, who want to get involved, what sort of things should they be doing?
You know, there's all kinds of things you can do. I think it is important to identify this phenomenon for what it is and call it out. Because as one of your earlier callers said, not enough people are talking about this, and we need to call it out. But I think we can also write, we can teach, we can organize, we can donate to organizations, we can vote, we can get active. Women and their men friends, and you had many men calling today who are friends of women, need to advocate more for girls and women in this country.
Susan Douglas has been our guest today, the author of Enlightened Sexism, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done. Susan Douglas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Bob. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, believe me. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for being the engineer, Melissa Trentz for being our great producer, and thank you all for listening. We'll be back in 167 hours. Bye, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy skies today with a high of 73 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 52. Monday, partly sunny skies, and there's a 30% chance of rain with a high of 75. Monday night, mostly cloudy, again a 30% chance of rain, a low of 48. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.